Welcome back to the Poor Pearls Almanac. This is Andy, and today we're joined by Barry Vaughn and Anya from Defend Rojava. Barry Vaughn Omar is a Kurdish feminist activist and social ecologist who lives in northeast Syria. Anya Rebri is an activist and author who is involved with the Emergency Committee for Rojava. Together, they'll be authoring a chapter in a book next year with AK Press titled Rojava in Focus, Critical Dialogues. And this book will be highlighting the successes and struggles the region has faced since its autonomy. And that's exactly what this episode is about. We're jumping into the messy reality of building a new vision of how societies should be organized and the role ecology has played in that process. While the region's dedication to feminism and anti-capitalism has made Rojava the model, which in the eyes of anarchists around the globe highlights the potential for revolutionary futures, the role of ecology tends to be lost. We talk about why this is the case, what's being done, and what the future looks like for ecology in the region and Rojava as a whole. I'm sure you all enjoy this conversation with these two inspiring people. To learn more about their work, check out at Defend Rojava on Instagram. Now to the episode. Thanks so much for coming on. Now, I think a lot of our audience is familiar enough with Rojava and the vision there. And we hear so much about this idea of cooperatives and gender equality action that's going on. But we don't hear too much about the ecology side, which is always this focal point of a lot of the vision of what a sustainable anarchist vision looks like. So first, please introduce yourself and tell us what's going on with this ecological front.
Good evening. I'm Barry Vaughn Omar from Rojava. I teach ecology in Rojava University. Also, I work in local administration here. First of all, I would like to thank you for having me on this program. It's true, not that many people talk about Rojava from this perspective. Most of the time, the focus is on defeating ISIS or gender equality, or as we call it, the women's revolution. These are extremely important matters. As they have transformed the region a lot, it has truly been a revolution, especially regarding the role of women in society. But as your listener probably already know, we rely on three main principles in our work: democracy, ecology, and women's freedom. Since the beginning of the revolution, the autonomous administration of North East Syria had to focus on so many issues, and ecology hasn't received much attention. This is because we have faced many challenges, especially those related to war, fighting against ISIS, and ongoing attacks from Turkish state. All of these factors have contributed to the lack of progress in the field, in North Syria. There is also another reason. There are not many advances in this field in Syria at all. There haven't been any effective awareness programs, which has left us somewhat unfamiliar with this concept. At the beginning of the revolution, as I mentioned, the concept was new to many, and there was a need for several years to work on the spreading environmental awareness, especially in the field of environmental care. The core concept used was social ecology, which is how to manage society in ecologically sustainable ways.
Yeah.
Can I jump in?
Go ahead.
Yeah, I would like to elaborate and give a little bit of context for those who may not be super familiar with Rojava. And my name is Anya Rebri, and I'm with the Emergency Committee for Rojava. And we've done solidarity work with the people, with the movement there in northeast Syria. But we are based in the United States. I just wanted to, for the background, to emphasize that the movement there had been trying to put in practice the philosophy of democratic confederalism that was developed by the leader of the Kurdish freedom movement, Abdullah Öcalan, the movement that first emerged in Turkey and now has also spread to Syria. And in this philosophy, Öcalan is trying to tackle all different types of oppression all at once. And that's what makes it so fascinating, what's happening in Northeast Syria right now. And in his writings, while he was in prison, he's still in prison in Turkey, but in his writings, you know, he tried to address the intersections between the oppressive structures of the state, of various types of hierarchy, patriarchy, capitalism, ethno-racial oppression, and also exploitation of nature. And he outlined the path towards liberation that addresses all these different structures of oppression. So his writings, his philosophy advocates for replacing the state with a confederation of communes, decentralized, directly democratic confederation of this village or neighborhood-based assemblies where people come together and decide on their collective issues together. And he rejects the nation state as a model of social organizing. So he advocates for autonomy and equal access to power for different ethno-religious groups, which is super important for the Middle East in particular, right? Given the history of and ethno-religious conflicts there, and the use of religion and ethnicity by imperialist powers and the nation states to maintain power. As you mentioned, the philosophy also advocates democratization of economy through cooperatives, but also restructuring of economy and restructuring of humans' relationship to nature more broadly in a way that's sustainable and it's not harmful for our non-human counterparts. So you can see that it's a very ambitious program, and clearly the 10 years have not been, or 12 years now, 12 years have not been enough to achieve everything that the movement has in mind. And the last thing perhaps to mention, and Berivan brought it up, that in terms of ecology in particular, Abdullah Öcalan was influenced by American thinker, historian, and philosopher Murray Bookchin, who developed the framework of social ecology and who argues that ecological problems are inherently social problems, so they cannot be addressed through technological intervention. They have to be addressed by reorganizing the society as a whole and by eradicating hierarchy and domination across different spheres of society. And so again, it's a very ambitious project.
Absolutely. And I think most people listening are excited to see how it develops and haven't been supportive of how it has developed to this point. But to your point, there's still a lot to do, especially on the ecological front. One of them, one in particular, I know that's been of concern, is the dependence on oil. And that seems like a really big, I don't want to say issue, but concern, given this framework of how society is supposed to be organized, that yet, despite all these great ideas, oil is still a foundational part of the economy in Rojava. So could you explain or talk maybe a little bit why there hasn't been much success moving away from oil?
Yes, regarding the oil, the issues of oil, it's indeed a problem. The entire region was built on the basis of exploiting the oil resources within it. When the autonomous administration was founded, they had no financial resources. And they also faced and still face a blockade from neighbor countries. Their only option was to utilize what was available and to gradual transition towards alternative energy sources. While the progress has been somewhat slow, there has been a noticeable improvement in the past 2 years through encouraging the use of solar energy. However, there are many obstacles, especially related to the lack of previous experience in this field and the lack of necessary technologies to implement a transition on a greater scale. In most cases, energy generated by solar panels is sufficient for a single household, and it has not been widely implemented to this day, remaining as an individual experiment.
Yeah, again, just to emphasize, when it comes to oil, as Berivan explained, the reason why the Thomas administration hasn't transition to alternative energy sources is not the lack of the will, it's really the circumstances under which this revolution is taking place. And, just think of it, if you are planning to have a revolution or any major social transformation, Syria in 2012 would have been like way down on the bottom of your list of choices. You know, it was an impossible place to have a revolution. But because of the opening that was provided by the Syrian civil war, the movement has had to step in and has had to, you know, try their best to implement this radical program in practice. You know, I want to elaborate a little bit more on the factors, on the obstacles that Berivan brought up. So one little known fact is that the autonomous administration has been under a de facto economic embargo, on one hand by the Syrian government, on the other hand by Turkey, and Turkey's proxy, the Kurdistan region of Iraq. So it's really difficult to bring things inside the region. And especially when it comes to developing solar energy sector, ideally, the autonomous administration has to build a solar panel factory, but they cannot do it under the current circumstances because the strategically important industrial and technical imports are practically impossible to bring in because, you know, as I mentioned, Turkey's proxy, the Kurdistan region of Iraq, controls the only functional border crossing with between Northeast Syria and the outside world. So that's one major issue. The solar panels that do get across into the region, they tend to be overpriced because of the black market around the border, or they tend to be of low quality because the autonomous administration doesn't have control over which companies they want to work with. And then another issue is, again, as Berivan mentioned, the lack of resources. Unfortunately, oil constitutes the major source of income for the administration at the moment, and they have not been able to develop other sectors of economy because of the war. It's been a war zone for a decade now. There have been two major invasions and occupations in the last few years. Turkey still attacks the region on a daily basis. And again, another little known fact, unfortunately, these attacks happen under the radar of the mainstream media, but even progressive media doesn't pay much attention. For example, in October last year, Turkey started systematically targeting civilian infrastructure in Northeast Syria, to basically undermine the region, to make the region uninhabitable, to make people miserable, and thus to undermine the popular support for the revolution, for the autonomous administration. And what they have done since October, they've carried out several bombing campaigns with fighter jets, with drones, hitting, deliberately targeting places like power and water stations, oil facilities, factories, food warehouses, even hospitals. So this is major, right? They damaged or rendered inoperable up to half of power and water infrastructure so far, leaving up to 2 million people with little access to water and power, but also, you know, the cost of damages are estimated to exceed $1 billion. I mean, just,
oh wow,
it's crazy to think how the autonomous administration can, you know, even start repairing all this infrastructure that has been targeted. So unfortunately, it would be, you know, it would be kind of suicidal for the region to declare that they're gonna stop relying on oil at this moment under these conditions until the time when, you know, they can actually develop other sectors of the economy.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely fair. And there's obvious repercussions to everything happening, from pollution, from facilities being destroyed, and all the other challenges that go with keeping people alive while also fighting a war, while also trying to transform everything fundamentally in a society. There's no less important piece, right? They're all equally important. And to Ocalan's point that you can't fix any of this without addressing the ecological component, yet it really hasn't gotten as much of a central focus, both in terms of actual practice as well as in terms of, I guess, interest from outside organizations, whether it's podcasts or reporters. You know, we keep talking about it being this socialist ecological vision, and a lot of attention has been paid on the socialist side, the feminist side, but not much on the ecological side. And I'm curious, how come you don't think the ecology hasn't gotten as much of that central focus, even though they're always described as these three tenets of the revolution?
If we are talking about the lack of attention among the local population, I might disagree, because when we talk about the environment, it does receive attention. However, we don't just focus on environment. We focus on the concept of social ecology, which is different a little bit. This means that we believe that to solve environmental problems and all the problems that humanity faces, we need to fundamentally reorganize society. This is achieved through the application of principles of decentralization and direct democracy. In Rojava, we have taken some effective steps in this regard. I say this because I lived in I lived a part of my life under the previous regime, and I still follow what is happening in Syria and other countries. So I can see the difference. One good example of how we have tried to implement social ecology in practice is the commune system. Communes exist in each village and neighborhood and play a significant role in decision-making progresses. They represent the smallest cell in the community organization and the new political system set up in Northeast Syria. They also form council for making general decisions. Here I want to talk about my experience in my work with the local administration. There have been many examples that prove that the communes make decisions related to their way of life in their specific geographical areas. In addition, in recent years, municipal work has changed significantly. All projects planned for any city or village now involve meetings with the residents of the city or village. The basic needs proposed by the residents are taken into consideration, and no project is officially approved without them voting for it. This approach has been instrumental in solving many environmental problems. For example, in the city of Kamishlo, there used to be a waste dump that caused problems to the local. Also, it was not a priority for the municipality administration initially. The residents agreed and voted for a project to address these issues, and it was successfully implemented.
Yeah, so Birvan sort of talked about the lack of attention, or the perceived lack of attention, or relative lack of attention internally by the movement. And yeah, indeed, you know, you can argue that there is that, but at the same time, they have been doing a lot on this front despite all odds. But you're asked also about the lack of attention sort of internationally and why these issues haven't been highlighted that much. And it's true, they have not. And strangely, because really Northeast Syria is at the intersection of such major issues. You have global climate change affecting the region in so many ways. You have Turkey's water wars that also contribute to the desertification of the region. And yet the issue has definitely remained sort of marginal, especially in leftist spaces. And, you know, my personal opinion, and I've been to the region twice, and, you know, I've met people working on the ecological front there. And I think the language barrier perhaps is one issue for sure. You know, we don't have that many people who speak enough English on the ground who can build relationships with the outside world, or, like, you know, give participate in podcasts like Berivan is doing right now. But perhaps, yeah, also just you know, sort of lack of progress on our part as well. In the United States, I can speak about the Emergency Committee for Rojava, and we have been trying to build bridges between activists and groups in the United States and activist movement members in Rojava. We have had sort of exchanges between cooperatives, co-ops in the United States and co-ops in Rojava, between trade unions here and trade unions there. And we would love to do something also on the ecological front, you know, with people like Berivan, who works with the local administration directly, or there is an organization that has been at the forefront of ecology-related work that's called Green Trust, and they have been actively seeking support and all kinds of exchanges with the outside world. And I think Berivan mentioned, you know, different solidarity relationships could be built around such basic things like just exchange of knowledge, because there is really a lack of expertise on this front because of the lack of attention to this issue before the region became autonomous, you know, under the Syrian government, as Berivan mentioned.
How do you address this issue of ecological restoration without knowledge and infrastructure to do it? It's not as simple as just saying we're going to plant 10 million trees that are native. Like, where are they coming from? How are you identifying them? How are you understanding how regions should look and how climate change and the destruction over the last 100 years plays into that?
Hey, we're taking a quick break in the episode to remind you that you can get a whole lot more information from poorproles.com. On our website, we have access to our supplemental reader for the podcast, which provides more depth and context, as well as thorough citations for all of the stuff we talk about in the show. You can also sign up for our newsletter, which updates you about limited releases, such as various nursery stock that we sometimes sell through the Poor Proles website, as well as updates about new merch that we have. You can also support the show through that website, poorproles.com, where you have access to our Patreon and our Substack to get early releases for articles and episodes. Now, if you enjoy the show and are just looking for even more audio content, go check out Tomorrow Today, which just wrapped up season one, or tune into The Gastropocene, which is a project of myself and Dr. Aisha Khan to discuss the way our diets have driven the Anthropocene and what it looks like to use our diets for good. Now, back to the show.
So I'd definitely like to dive in a little deeper on this conversation of ecology and agroecology. So first, there are a lot of inspiring projects that I've seen in Rojava over the past decade. The Slow Food Gardens in Kobani, which worked with kids to inspire them to value ecology, as well as the women's only agricultural cooperatives. And I feel like I heard a lot about these movements or these projects like 5-7 years ago. And looking for updates on any of this seems to be sparse, to your point of there's probably things going on, it's just not getting out to the rest of the world. And that's, I guess, what I'm trying to do. So I guess, are these projects continuing to develop and expand? And are there new projects similar to these or even more agroecologically focused?
I will try to talk about something that I was a part of it, because I work on it, I have experience in it. So indeed, there have been several inspiring initiatives in our region since the beginning of the revolution. One important example that I would like to mention is the Zero Waste Project that was started in the city of Hasaka a couple of years ago. It was unmanageable to talk about waste sorting and recycling in the past, while it might be considered ordinary for people in the West. For us, it was exceptional. Throughout our lives, we used to dispose of mixed waste in the streets, which would then be collected and dumped in a landfill, causing environmental pollution and health issues. Today, we see some projects that are the first steps towards establishing a proper waste management system. As a part of the Zero Waste Project, several communes sort their waste at home and then take it to recycling facilities. Additionally, they utilize organic waste to produce compost for agricultural purposes. There has also been a noticeable shift toward tree planting and home vegetable gardening among many residents in the field of agriculture. In this regard, it's important to emphasize that the Syrian government exploited our region for resources extraction, using most of the land for monocultures like wheat. Planting trees was even criminalized under the Assad regime. So reforestation is an important step to decolonize our region. Our region also experienced deforestation because of the war. Some trees were cut down by ISIS. Additionally, people used trees for fuel and cooking when there was a shortage of the fuel sources. To fix this problem, we focused on training people how to plant trees. From 2015 to 2023, we planted about 400,000 trees. We also have worked with schools to get students involved. I think this is a great way to change people's thinking and make them care more about the environment. Also in the school, there are environment committees made up of teachers, and cleaning staff have been replaced by collaboration between teachers and students who now collectively clean the schools. Furthermore, our universities have introduced environmental science courses in most departments with a special focus on social ecology. This could not have been implemented 10 years ago.
Yeah, maybe just more examples of practices that aim to restore traditional knowledges, traditional techniques. I'm sure people have heard about the women-only eco-village called Jinwar, which was designed and set up by the women's movement in Northeast Syria as a sort of safe space for women who have had a traumatic experience with patriarchy, be it ISIS or even just domestic abuse. But what they also are trying to do is to, you know, sort of recover traditional ways of being in various aspects of life. So for example, they have built their own homes by using local clay, by using this traditional practice of building clay houses, as well as applying, you know, traditional shapes in order to increase thermal efficiency of these buildings. They also engage in organic farming, you know, trying to cut down the use of chemicals, practicing crop rotation, you know, on the same land where monoculture was practiced not so long ago by the Syrian government. You know, they collect rainwater and groundwater for irrigation. We try to integrate cattle raising into the agricultural production. Also, you know, thinking how to introduce techniques like permaculture. So, you know, definitely kind of a lot of activity in this regard happening there. There is another example now, a women-run center in Kamishlo, one of the major cities on the northern, you know, in the north, where women try to encourage a broader population to use more herbal, more traditional plant-based remedies instead of relying on Western allopathic medicine exclusively. And they try to cultivate their own plants, especially those that are local to the region. But then, of course, there is a challenge that you brought up, the fact that, you know, it's difficult to get the seeds of the local plants. For example, Berivan brought up the tree planting campaign. That was the first obstacle that they faced. They didn't have the seeds, and that's partially due to the colonial relationship that the Syrian government established with this region, but also due to the centralization of agriculture by the Assad regime before the revolution. To control this sector, they were controlling the production and distribution of seeds. And so when the war broke out and the region became de facto autonomous, they were not able to access their own seeds because those were based in Syrian government's seed banks. And so it's an ironic situation that these seeds, the region for decades was a breadbasket of the entire country. But then once they cut the relationship with the Syrian government, they were not able to access the seeds that had come from this region.
Yeah.
Seeds of the local varieties. And so that's still an issue that the autonomous administration has to deal with. And, you know, of course, they're trying to recover, trying to develop local varieties. But again, you know, they lack expertise. It was never done before locally. They lack equipment, you know, they're like labs, they like genetic materials. So that's definitely, you know, a struggle.
Yeah, absolutely. I can only imagine. So I'd also like to talk about contextualizing some of what's been going on in Rojava with what's also another very big movement in the area, the Mesopotamian ecology movement, and with some very similar politics and understanding of ecology as what is the foundation of Rojava. For folks that are unfamiliar with the Mesopotamian ecology movement, they're a decentralized movement centered around agroecological principles that sprung up in response to damming and other ecological destruction, and kind of has multiple facets of how it's organized in Turkey. One of the things they focus on is this restoration of traditional practices, which they argue can handle the current droughts and water shortages that are being experienced now. While they're not in Rojava, I think they point to a lot of the same challenges that you guys are facing. And it has me wondering about if there have been any initiatives to restore traditional practices which can handle those current droughts that you're experiencing and the water shortages, artificial or natural, that are being experienced in the region? Or is there any work being done to like restore traditional crops or traditional varieties? And in that process, sorry, this is a very long question, I guess. What kind of feedback are you getting from citizens about this idea of going back after being acclimated to these like conventional crops that were really bred to be able to be sold on a bigger market?
Yeah, in this regard, I will talk about my personal experience in something called artificial forests. We work on this project called to plant the trees native to the area. So far, we have had three projects of this kind. We go to some people who still have some trees. They take care about it. So we take part of the trees and then we take care of it. And now we planted it in some areas. So now we have three projects of this. In addition to that, farmers are encouraged to diversify their crops. Now there is many crops here. And now the focus is on many varieties that have been absent from the region for a long time because of the monoculture approach of the Syrian government. In this field of vegetable cultivation, it's in general done in most villages, and they rely on their own crops. They has reduced production costs and the use of preservative and pesticides. As for the cities, work is still being done to implement vegetable gardens, which are part of our future project.
Yeah, maybe just go to the question of water shortages. Again, for the context, right, it's not, you know, the region has experienced historic droughts in the last decade, and it's not just because of the global climate change. That definitely is at play, but also due to Turkey's use of water as a weapon of war. And what Turkey has been doing, and that's where, you know, you see the connection between the work that the Mesopotamian ecology movement have been doing in the north, right, of northeast Syria, in the Kurdistan, part of Kurdistan that's been, you know, colonized by Turkey. So Turkey has been using its dams to decrease the downstream flow of the Euphrates River into Syria, intentionally, again, to deprive the region of water. You know, as I mentioned before, that's sort of a multifaceted long-term strategy to undermine the autonomous administration, and depriving people of water is one tactic that Turkey has been using. And those are the same dams that the Mesopotamian ecology movement have been fighting up north within Turkey, within the borders of Turkey, for a variety of reasons, right? But the effect, the impact in northeast Syria has been quite dramatic. You know, you see I visited some villages that disappeared. They just ghost villages now. People had to leave because their rivers dried up, you know, because of this policy of Turkey. Agricultural lands are drying up. The region's, the Thomas administration's hydroelectric sector has, you know, has seen a decrease in its capacity to generate electricity. So the impact has been quite drastic. And unfortunately, I'm afraid that addressing this issue would require international kind of diplomatic and political pressure on Turkey, just because of the scale of the problem that they're able to cause by weaponizing water.
We had talked about, or I'd asked about the traditional crops and traditional varieties. Are people interested in that, or did they like the way things are around their food choices?
Yeah, it's something difficult. Not all of them are interested about it. But now after many years of having a lot of efforts on this, like training and making many seminars, showing them the importance of this thing. So it's good. It's become better. Year by year, it's become better. Now it's better a lot. But I want to mention something here. Many years ago, I can say when we were living in the Syrian regime, there were no initiatives for taking care of environment. But now here in the autonomous administration time, there is a lot of initiatives, more than 20 initiatives who are talking about the environment, want to make change, want to plant tree, have an awareness program. So it's really important they're making change. Maybe it's a little bit slow, but we have hope that it will be better in the future.
Awesome. For people that are listening, what can they do to support what you guys are doing? I mean, I know they can't send seeds in or anything like that, but what kind of things can people do to support you?
I want to talk about some difficulties. Really, we experienced a lot of obstacles from the beginning of the revolution until now, from ISIS to the climate change to drought. But I want to emphasize that the biggest threat to the revolution at the present time is the attack of Turkish state that targeted the people who work for the success of revolution and civilians and infrastructure. And I want to add something. Now, a few minutes ago, they targeted a car here in Pamuklu in the city, and there was a people who were working in the hospital. Their doctor, they were working in the hospital for helping people. But now I heard about the phone that they targeted the car. It has caused a great loss of our colleagues whose goals was to secure a better life for the people of this region. The instability and lack of security also opened the door to immigration, especially by the youth who we need at this time. What encouraged us to continue to work under these difficult conditions, the presence of friends like you who have been supportive of us on our path to carry on this unique and inspiring experience.
Yeah, I would say that there are a lot of ways in which people could support the ecological struggle in particular. And I already mentioned that, you know, it could be done on a very basic level just by exchanging information, exchanging experience. And I would definitely encourage people, whoever is listening, to reach out. You know, you can reach out to the organization that I work with, which is Emergency Committee for Rojava. We can put you in direct touch with Berivan. We can put you in touch with the organization called Green Tress, which I also mentioned, who do this type of work and who have been looking for allies outside Rojava as well. And I assume, you know, your listeners, most of them are US-based, and we always emphasize in our solidarity work that we as constituents, you know, unfortunately, we're constituents of our government. I know it's not really representative of, you know, of our wishes as Americans, but because the United States has been complicit in Turkey's war on the Kurds and on Northeast Syria, we believe that we have sort of additional responsibility to express support and solidarity with Northeast Syria. And again, we would love to help to build bridges between groups that have similar values or do similar work as that, which is being done by Berivan and her colleagues in Northeast Syria. And I would definitely welcome people to reach out and to brainstorm how we can support.
Finding new ways to keep the pressure on what's happening is important. And to the point of, there was this boom of information about Rojava 5, 6, 7 years ago, but it's lost its immediacy, I think, for a lot of Americans. And that, okay, this thing is going, it's been going, it's going, and that's about it. And there does need to be more attention paid to what's happening and what we can do, and being aware of the challenges that are still being faced there, new challenges in many cases, and doing what we can to support folks over there. So Anya, Berivan, this has been really interesting and fascinating and inspiring, and I'm confident that things will continue to progress there. And of course, our platform is always open to you guys.
Thank you so much for hosting us.
Thank you very much.
Appreciate it.